Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. A lack of affordable housing. This complaint came up again and again during our recent series on New Hampshire's workforce shortage. Many said high housing prices and low inventory were huge obstacles in attracting and retaining great workers. Still, some cities and towns hesitate to welcome affordable housing developments, citing a variety of issues, from traffic to property taxes to absentee landlords. It's an ongoing balance between these community concerns and the needs of Granite Staters seeking a decent roof over their heads. And it's a gap that New Hampshire's nonprofit housing providers are increasingly trying to fill. Today in The Exchange, the nonprofit sector's unique role in housing availability and affordability. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Rosemary Hurd, President and CEO of Catch Neighborhood Housing, working in Merrimack County. And Rosemary, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Lovely to meet you, too, and thanks for the invitation.
Also with us, Mike Claflin, Executive Director of AHEAD, which stands for Affordable Housing and Education Development, covering northern Grafton County and all of Coos County. Mike, thank you for making the trip. We appreciate you being here.
Morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Kristen, Executive Director and CEO of the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And Dean, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Thank you for having me, as usual.
Well, and Dean, first to you, before we get into the differences and similarities between the nonprofit and for-profit housing worlds, just describe the shortage, Dean, this affordable housing shortage that we hear about all the time. What does it look like?
So we have a shortage both on the single-family side and on the multifamily side in our housing stock across much of the state. The inventory, for instance, of for-sale housing is extremely low in most of the state. It's hovering around 3 to 4 months' supply. And so you compare that to sort of normal averages, ought to be 5 or 6 months of housing. And the way we track inventory is we take a look at how long would it take to sell all the houses that are on the market now, and that's where you get those numbers from. And it's actually much worse at the lower end of the market. So housing under 300,000 is probably about 3 months. And that's a statewide number. It varies dramatically. In some parts of the state, it's much, much lower than that. And you hear anecdotal stories about people putting reasonably priced homes on the market in the southern part of the state and them selling within 24 hours. On the rental side, I think it's even more challenging. We just have updated our data on vacancy rates across the state, and they're hovering below 1%. And
that's below 1%.
It's just extraordinary when you consider that sort of the national average for vacancy of multifamily housing is probably about 7%. The regional numbers in New England is around 5%. That's about what people think of as a balanced market. In some markets in our state, it's well under 1%. Statewide, it's hovering about 1%. There's some regional variances in that, but the reality is that we have a very, very tight housing market.
So as I mentioned, we heard from so many people, Dean, during our workforce shortage series about this housing issue. But we heard from a couple people who were skeptical of this. They felt that all the discussion right now about affordable housing was being promoted by builders who just wanted an excuse to push communities around, to build wherever they wanted. Address that skepticism, Dean.
Well, I would tell you that there's a lot more people that are concerned about this than builders. And so you hear this issue from employers, as you noted, who are very concerned about their ability to recruit and retain employees because of this, as well as from consumers themselves. And this is not an issue that has been sort of manufactured by some small number of builders. And the data bears out the fact that we have these very low vacancy rates, these very low inventories of homes for sale. It is borne out by prices. Prices keep going up. And so the price of a median home in New Hampshire now is about $280,000. And that goes up 4 or 5% every year based on recent data. The price of a two-bedroom apartment statewide is up over $1,300, also about a 4% increase. Those are real numbers. Those are not things that people are manufacturing. I think the notion that builders are sort of manufacturing a shortage so that they can sort of, as you put it, push communities around is very unrealistic. In fact, the development community would tell you that they feel pushed around a lot more than the other way when it comes to trying to actually get things done.
Rosemary, what kind of housing needs are you seeing in Merrimack County?
Well, we are seeing a lot of our residents, and we touch the lives of about 600 residents every day. They are looking for quality, affordable housing in areas that are conducive to a reasonable commute to work. And this, Laura, is an economic development issue as well as having a roof over your head, which is a reasonable expectation. We've seen this issue highlighted by the Business and Industry Association, for example. And all of their members are highlighting this need for affordable housing on a daily basis. So a lot of our residents support a lot of businesses in the Concord area every day, and they just need places that they can live and feel comfortable and feel like that they have a landlord that they can trust who's there every day to maintain the property once it's built.
What do they tell you they want, Rosemary? Is it they just want a decent apartment that doesn't break the bank? Is it that they've been living in an apartment for a while and they'd like to buy, but there's nothing available in their price range? What do people want in terms of affordable housing in the Merrimack area?
We really see a combination. Many of our residents have gone on to purchase homes, for example, and we have a home buyer education center that we run in partnership with NeighborWorks of Southern New Hampshire. So we have seen that perfect situation where somebody lives in our affordable apartment, saves for a home, and winds up in that wonderful place where they're homeowners. We also see people who just simply need an apartment, but a quality one, and one that everybody has a reasonable expectation, right, that there ought to be apartments of quality that are affordable to a range of people. And after all, that's how cities and towns grow organically, that there's a range of housing options for any number of people who live in those towns. So it really depends on the individual's needs. But first and foremost, it's quality.
You work in Merrimack County, known in the greater Concord area. What do you hear, Rosemary, from your colleagues in other parts of the state, like southern New Hampshire, where Dean mentioned the market is very hot?
Absolutely. Well, Dean just mentioned earlier about the inventory, for example, of homes for sale. I consulted with Robert Tourney, who's the executive director of NeighborWorks Southern New Hampshire. And Robert shared with me that for sale inventory, for example, is really being impacted by empty nesters and their cash buyers. So from a seller's perspective, that means that there is really no contingency in that sale, that they can go ahead and close it quickly, whereas a first-time home buyer is always subject to financing and so on and so forth. He is also seeing that their vacancies are remaining really, really low. But he said more families are struggling to pay their rent, and they also don't want to lose their apartment because there's nothing else in that affordable realm. He's also mentioned to me that multiple offers in on that category that Dean alluded to earlier. And the other really important point that he made is that existing owners have no reason to sell their current properties because they can command high rents. And neither do they have any pressure to do great things to that property. So in
terms of vacancy rates so low.
Exactly, because of vacancy rates so low.
Wow. So And we're definitely going to talk about the role that your group, Rosemary, and Mike, that your organization plays in kind of breaking through all those market forces that you talk about, Rosemary. Yeah, Dean, go ahead. You want to jump in?
So I just want to reinforce a point that Rosemary made, which is that this is really a supply problem. There's a lack of production of either single-family homes or multifamily homes across the state. And when you have an environment like that, I mean, housing is a commodity. It's a supply and demand dynamic. And when you have not enough supply and a lot of demand, it's going to result in rising prices and all these other things we're talking about, competition between buyers that might not otherwise occur, that causes particularly first-time buyers to be disadvantaged in an environment like this.
So, Mike, how about you? Rosemary, describe what she's seeing in Merrimack County, what her colleagues in southern New Hampshire are seeing. What are you seeing in northern Grafton County and all of Coos County, where you work?
Well, we're not unlike the rest of the state. Our conditions, though, are somewhat complicated by distances that are involved for employment. I think that the aging of our community is a little bit more so than the rest of the state, so we have that issue. Like Dean mentioned, it's a matter of scale, and Littleton's one of the few towns that actually seen an increase in millennial population, and there's nowhere for these families to live just because they're physically not available. And the only other thing that I think might be perhaps different is we have a lot of resort communities, and in those particular communities in the rural areas of the state, the price of land is so high and the development is so prohibitive because of the economy of scale again. But all in all, I think that's our primary challenge is in the rural parts of the state.
So you have a shortage, too. It just looks a little different and has slightly different reasons and causes, Mike, than perhaps in southern New Hampshire?
Correct.
You know, the impression that sometimes people have, and maybe this was true 10 years ago, is that there was plenty of housing in the North Country because the area was being depopulated, so there were plenty of affordable houses for sale. I remember a friend of mine 15 years ago got a lovely little house for $40,000 in Berlin. So is that no longer the case?
That really is not the case. The quality of the housing, the existing housing stock, has gone down. The other issue is that because of the reduction in employment opportunities, such as the mills in Berlin, that's had an economic impact on the rents that are paid and what people can afford. So I would not say that there's an overabundance of housing stock in the rural areas.
Our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking once again at the state's affordable housing shortage, both in terms of rental and ownership, but we're focusing this hour on the role that nonprofit housing providers play. And as we're going to hear, it can be a different approach from the for-profit sector when it comes to financing, construction, and the relationships with residents and communities. Let's get your thoughts on this. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So one more definition, Dean, I want to get out of the way before we really jump into the nonprofit model and how unique it is. We're going to say affordable housing a lot this hour. So what is affordable? What's affordable for me might be different than what's affordable to you.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, the term affordable housing at its core is the notion that people should not pay more than 30% of their income for their housing. And that's a national standard, a federal standard that was developed a long time ago. And it's based on the idea that people have other things they need to pay for in their life, and that if they're paying more than 30% of their income for their housing, then they may not be able to pay for all those other things. Clearly, if you're at the lower end of the income spectrum, that is going to be even more challenging than it would be if you were at a higher part of the income spectrum. But that's the basic concept. The concept is that you ought to not pay more than 30% of your income for housing. Now, what does that mean? It means that if the median rent is over $1,300, then you need to have a household income of over $50,000 in order to hit that standard. And that becomes very challenging for particularly entry-level workers in many of our businesses and communities around the state.
Now, you said that's been the standard for a long time, the 30% standard. Is it still relevant? Because the cost of other items that people need these days has gone way up. The cost of healthcare is way, way more than it was 20 or 30 years ago. 20, 30 years ago, people didn't need expensive phones, with that, you know, $40, $50 a month plan. I mean, it seems like overall costs have gone up. So I wonder about that 30%.
Well, there's an argument both ways there, frankly, which is that maybe we ought to reevaluate the standard because as a practical matter, most people are probably paying more than 30% of their income for their housing.
Really?
And in fact, the data shows that there's a significant amount of overpayment both by renters and homeowners for housing if you use the 30% standard. And you point out a lot of the reasons why on the other side of the equation, there might be an argument in favor of saying, well, should housing even cost that much of your overall income?
30% is a lot.
Given everything else that we now expect people to be able to carry, in addition to, for instance, student debt, which is a huge factor, particularly for that millennial population that was mentioned earlier. So we could probably have a show on this. The fact is that that is the standard, I think, that most organizations and entities that look at housing issues use. It gives us a good measure of what is, in fact, affordable or not for an individual.
And part of the reason I ask about this is we put this question out to our Facebook community, and a lot of people jumped in and said 30%, way too much. It should be 20% or 25%. That feels more reasonable, especially given the high cost of a lot of other items and the student debt that you mentioned. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. We'd really like your questions, comments, and personal experiences on affordable housing today in the Exchange, especially with this focus that we're providing this hour on the nonprofit sector's role. And let's dig into that now. And Mike, how do you as a nonprofit address housing differently than a for-profit might?
I think traditionally nonprofit organizations provide services and products that most other organizations or companies don't provide. We fill a need, a niche. You know, you go back to this discussion about what's affordability, and you say 30%. Well, if you're making $8 an hour, 30% is not very much, and you're certainly not going to pay much of a rent anywhere. So we're asked to try to provide housing and services that require the working together of different funding sources. As a nonprofit, we oftentimes have the ability for funding sources that other organizations don't have. The other thing is that we keep talking about this economy of scales, and that our biggest challenge, especially in the rural areas, is the ability to get a big enough market to pay for things. And so we have to find challenging ways of getting new funding sources that normally, if you were in down in the southern part of the state, you could get a traditional bank loan and you would be able to charge rents high enough to pay the bank back. But oftentimes we don't have that luxury in the North Country.
How about dealing with communities, zoning boards, planning boards, and so forth? Is that different for a nonprofit than a for-profit, or is it pretty much the same process?
I think it's pretty much the same process. I think what might be different is that, at least in our case, we go to the smaller communities because of the economy of scales to offer an affordable housing development project, whereas a for-profit might not go there because of the economic, you know, issue. So we're the only game in town, so when they have to, you know, have issues, they'll come after us. But I don't think it's really much different than a for-profit versus a nonprofit. Just the fact that we'll attempt to do something that a for-profit developer might not try to do.
That's interesting. So you might not face community opposition. We don't want this development here. It's going to create traffic or cause problems or whatever. You might not face that because you're the only game in town.
Well, no, I don't want to give you that idea. We certainly face all of those issues, but it's not because we're a nonprofit.
It's just the issues
that
would come.
Just because we are a developer.
Okay.
Correct.
Rosemary, I'll definitely get your thoughts on that also after a short break.
Wonderful.
The differences between for-profit and nonprofit. Also, we'll take your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, more on how the state's nonprofits are trying to fill the affordable housing gap in the state. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org.
Recently on The Exchange, transgender panelists answer a listener's question about how to talk about those times before their child transitioned.
Just because they've come out as trans does not lessen that experience. Do you still own those memories? And I would say to any parent, those memories are yours of your child. It's just being thoughtful both to what you need as a parent and understanding that your first priority is to make sure that your child is loved.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Weekday mornings at 9, only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the role nonprofit housing providers play as the state tries to ease an affordable housing shortage. Let's hear from you. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Mike Claflin, Executive Director of AHEAD, which stands for Affordable Housing and Education Development. Mike works in Northern Grafton County and all of Coos County. Also with us, Dean Kristen, Executive Director and CEO of the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, and Rosemary Hurd, President and CEO of Catch Neighborhood Housing, working in Merrimack County. And Rosemary, to you too. Mike was talking about this just before the break. How do you approach housing development differently than a for-profit provider?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I think, Laura, we should talk about the cost of developing housing, because that really is what has created the need for nonprofits to step into that arena. So if one is a for-profit developer, construction costs are high, land is scarce, and the numbers don't work unless you have a ton of equity to bring to the deal. If you finance a deal on a conventional basis, debt to equity, you just can't make those numbers work. So that's why we're not seeing a ton of developers coming into New Hampshire in general to develop housing. So I think what sets us apart is our ability to leverage programs that were designed to further the development of affordable housing. The low-income housing tax credit is a great example of a program that has a huge impact in New Hampshire. And this is a program that Dean, through New Hampshire Housing, oversees, and one that has allowed us to leverage $32 million in equity to bring to the table to be able to develop the properties that we have developed to date. So without that and without other sources of funding, we would not be able to do what we do. I think the other thing that maybe sets us apart is the fact that because of mission and vision, we are there after the property is developed. So we are very focused on the resident. It's not just about the bricks and mortar. And I think that overall, all nonprofits share that similar focus. We want to ensure that we have residents who are successful and who are able to manage their day-to-day lives and pay their rent. We may be nonprofit organizations, but at the end of the day, we are also nonprofit enterprises. So we have an obligation to keep our doors open for other people, and therefore it is incumbent upon us to make sure that people are skilled in areas of financial fitness and being able to pay that rent every month, albeit a real hardship on a lot of folks.
That's really interesting, and I want to ask everybody about that in just a moment. But let's go to our listeners. Again, the number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We're talking about affordable housing today in The Exchange and the shortage of it in New Hampshire and the role New Hampshire's nonprofits play in filling that gap. Let's hear from you. Again, you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. And Suzanne is calling in. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. I have a 98-year-old mother who's been in a apartment complex in Concord for the last 5 years or so. Her rent has gone from $900 a month to $1,000 a month. But what's really outrageous for us, 98-year-old person who's on Social Security fixed income. And to top it off, her apartment's not energy efficient, so her electricity bill is a couple hundred dollars a month because of the inefficient building. The building was built 30, 40 years ago. It's a fine building, but if you have affordable housing for both low income and all people, they should look at energy efficiency. With our climate change problem, we really need to be very much aware of that. And the other thing is, you had a comment, somebody needs a $40 cell phone. we don't need cell phones. You can get cell phones for $11 a month.
Sure. And no, I hear you,
don't
Suzanne.
Don't need cable TV. Go to the library.
Yeah. Well, I hear you. And I guess the point I was trying to make, Dean, is that there are a lot of expenses that people choose to make these days that that do start to add up. But Suzanne's absolutely right. It's a personal choice how much you spend on a cell phone and whether you decide to subscribe to streaming services or not.
That's true. A lot of those are, in fact, personal choices. She's absolutely right. It's also true that, as Mike pointed out, given the dynamic of New Hampshire and the semi-rural nature of a lot of the areas of our state, people have to commute long distances to go to work, which means that you need a car, and that and the cost of transportation to work can be a significant burden for people. So there are things that are not discretionary that can impact the ability of people to afford housing. The student debt component is a significant portion of that as well. And I think many would argue that some of those things, having a cell phone, having access to the internet, are not as discretionary as perhaps we all thought they once were 10 years or so ago, perhaps.
What about the energy issue that she raises? Rosemary, do you want to jump in? The idea that, you know, this is another cost of housing affordability.
Absolutely. But I think this highlights a huge need in our state. We're an aging state. And we're just scratching the surface of the need for folks to have housing to support our seniors. We have one development in the Catch portfolio that is focused on seniors only. But what we're seeing is the need not only for the housing piece, but for some level of supportive services. And we have a pilot program right now with Concord Regional VNA called PATHS, Positive Aging Through Home Supports, where we are trying to find ways to support our seniors on the health level as well, that nexus between health and housing we're seeing more and more and more. And frankly, as we go down 5 and 10 years, this need is going to become huge across the state. We're already seeing that. So I absolutely sympathize with our listener. $900 to $1,000 a month is a huge amount of money for any senior. And frankly, we're dealing with seniors today who worked all of their lives, had a reasonable expectation that they would have a retirement income, and do not. So they're making choices between paying the rent, taking medications, and that's a really tough choice, or putting food on the table. We're seeing a ton of seniors who are food insecure as well today.
Well, and I want to ask you about that as well, Mike. But let's go back to our listeners for a moment. Ian's calling in from Deerfield. Hi, Ian. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Ian.
So I had a comment. I'm a landlord. I own 4 properties, and I live in one, and 2 others are in New Hampshire. And my comment is twofold. One, we have a lot of debt as a family. So we have tractor payment, car payment, student loan payment that is bigger than our mortgage on the house we own. So we're constrained by all that debt. That's about 70% of our income. And then the other side of it is, as I'm renting, like the cost that I incur, I'm a contractor as well, so I buy houses out of foreclosure and fix them up myself. But I have, like, taxes, which are very high in New Hampshire. I've got energy bills to pay. And then the cost of materials is sky high now. Like a piece of plywood is $50.
Wow.
Yeah.
So your point, Mike, is Ian, is that you'd like to provide more affordable housing,
exactly.
but it's really not feeling very affordable for you. Is that what you're trying to say?
It's not affordable for me as a landlord to provide affordable housing. So how can I do that then? Like, I'm not a nonprofit, obviously, but I'd like to have lower rents, but I frankly can't afford it.
You know, Ian, I'm really glad you called, and Mike to you first, but anybody else jump in.
Well, he brings a really valid point. The cost of construction is skyrocketing, and it's having an amazing impact on all of the costs that are associated with developing this need that we have. And it's, that I think is the crux of the problem. This caller, just multiply it by 100. If you have a much larger contractor, he's got it the same costs, and he's got to try to figure out a way to come up with a formula that they can provide a rent that's affordable for the families.
So he's saying, I'd like to offer affordable housing, but I just can't. The costs are too big.
Right. As a nonprofit developer, we still have the same challenges. It costs us just as much to build properties. And so, you know, we have other ways that we can sometimes try to lessen that burden, but we still have the same challenges.
Sure. Go ahead, Dean, and then Rosemary.
So the cost of construction has clearly gone up, and there's no doubt about it. And part of it is related to a lot of international factors that are just beyond the control of anybody in New
Trade
Hampshire.
Trade disputes with Canada over lumber.
Tariffs and shortages.
Steel tariffs.
And you know, and natural disasters that you know, create demand for certain types of things. It's also true that this industry, that is the construction industry, is suffering from the same labor challenges that a lot of others are, and therefore the cost of labor is up. And those kind of things, which is why we have, that is, New Hampshire Housing and a lot of the other folks in the housing community have argued that we need to look at what can we control in the cost of creating new housing. And one of those really is the cost of land and the cost of the regulatory and other processes that go on before you can actually build something. And those things really are subject to sort of local, if you will, public policy decision-making that impact them. So when you make a decision about how many houses you're going to allow on a particular piece of land or what kind of development, how much it's going to cost to build because of the things you require of a developer, those things add to cost in a way that may not be as, if you will, necessary or as uncontrollable as the cost of a piece of plywood may well be. And so focusing on those issues is an important component. I just want to take a quick moment, if I may, also want to talk about the energy issue. It's a really valid issue. We have been looking at this for years. We've been working with our partners in the portfolio and have made efforts to improve the energy efficiency in a lot of the properties that we've financed over the years. But there's a lot more that could be done in that area. And I think it's an area of focus for the state's utilities, who have some resources that can be focused on that, as well as other funders.
Well, that our caller raised, the utilities that her grandmother is paying and so forth. And it's great to hear from you, Ian, and just how you're sort of dealing with this as a landlord. Rosemary, you wanted to jump in on Ian's point.
Absolutely. First of all, Ian, I commend you on the balancing act of having 70% of your income eaten up, but also being able to provide housing at the same time. And of course, we never want to see people going to foreclosure, but unfortunately, it is a reality for some. And in doing so, you're also providing that community revitalization piece of our market as well. But to the point of real estate taxes, for example, even though we are nonprofit organizations, CATCH pays over $500,000 a year to the cities and towns in real estate taxes. So we do not get a break on that.
That's interesting. And I did want to ask you that, because often nonprofits do get a break on property taxes. But you're saying
we do not.
Now, why is that, Rosemary?
I hate to say it's been the way it's always been. We do get a little bit of a break on the low-income housing tax credit developments. And a couple of years ago, there was a bill that gave us a little bit of flexibility there. But overall, you know, $550,000 is not a small amount of money for an organization like CATCH. And I'm sure my colleague here, Mike Claflin up at Ahead, has the same issue. So it would be wonderful to find ways to provide incentives to folks like Ian to create more housing, because that really is the crux of the matter, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit. We need more housing.
Go ahead, Dean.
So New Hampshire law does not necessarily provide an opportunity for nonprofits who are doing housing work to get an exemption from local property taxes in and of itself. And most of the properties that we fund, whether they're developed by for-profit or nonprofit entities, pay property taxes. And as Rosemary points out, the legislature did create a little bit of a carve-out for certain kinds of affordable housing properties, but they still are required to pay property taxes, just at a slightly different rate than others.
Well, and that would be tough for the city or town, right, Dean?
Right.
You know, to sort of write off a whole swath of housing as not providing property taxes, that would increase the burden on everybody else.
That's
so
right.
There's the fairness issue there. Let's go back to the phones, and Joshua's calling in from Lebanon. Hi, Joshua, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joshua.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'd like to make a couple of points. One, our expectation of housing has changed dramatically. In the 1970s, the average size home was 1,500 square feet, and today it's 2,400 square feet. So our definition of affordability hasn't changed, but the size of the home has changed significantly. And the other thought is that if you're working full time and earning minimum wage and you can't afford housing so that a nonprofit organization has to step in to help you, what you're doing is you're subsidizing the employer who's not paying enough. If you raise the basic minimum wage to an affordable point, the employer would have to pay enough for people to afford housing as opposed to a nonprofit.
Joshua, I'm so glad you called, because this also came up, Mike, during our workforce shortage series. People said that, you know, we wouldn't have a workforce shortage if New Hampshire employers paid more. Josh was making the point, we wouldn't have an affordable housing shortage if people could afford more. So what is the employer responsibility in this?
Well, I agree. I mean, but traditionally or historically, what people have done is they've gone out and gotten two or three jobs and not forced the raising of the wages. I mean, I think that would go a long ways towards helping people be able to afford the housing and all of the other leftover expenses that they need to raise a family. But the caller has a good point.
What's the cultural statement that that makes, Dean, that, as Joshua says, nonprofits are having to step in and help people afford a roof over their heads because they're not making enough to pay it on their own?
The dynamic, I think, of what businesses pay for certain types of work is, you know, really complex, and it has to do with the fact that we're really in a national and international economy, and it becomes very difficult to say simply that, well, people just ought to pay more for that. That might make that business non-competitive. It might make that business, you know, financially infeasible in that community, and that could lead to the loss of all those jobs in that community. So I'm not going to say that in all cases that couldn't be helpful, but I think it's a little bit, with all due respect, of an oversimplification of the issue to say that if businesses just paid more, that the problem would go away.
Well, it's a little more complicated, I understand, and that gets into some of the debate now about raising the minimum wage to, you know, 12 or 15. Some people say this is going to create overall inflation, so, you know, then the price of everything goes up. So I understand what you're saying. It's complicated. Rosemary, do you want to jump in?
Yes, thank you, and thank you for your call, Joshua. So it does raise the issue of the fact that a living wage in New Hampshire is $22 an hour. So Mike said, and correctly so, that many of our residents are working multiple jobs to make ends meet. But if you look at New Hampshire in the context of other New England states as it relates to minimum wage, we are at the bottom of the ladder. There's no reasonable expectation that one could live on $7.50 an hour and be able to put a roof over your head and food on your table. So it is a dilemma. I would also like to talk to his house size comment, which is very relevant today. And I think we're going to see a lot more homes in the larger square footage come on the market here in the coming years as the population ages and people want to get into smaller homes. That's going to create a glut of larger homes. So the whole tiny home or smaller home discussion is one that we need to have more of. But I think it's also important to point out that when we're delivering affordable housing units, we're delivering smaller units. 450 square feet for one bedroom units. And so on. So it's an ongoing conversation.
And it seems like, Rosemary, the trend now is more toward smaller homes and apartments.
Absolutely.
Joshua, thank you so much for joining us. And you can comment too. Send your comments in by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. More on how the state's nonprofits are trying to ease the affordable housing shortage in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Have you ever wondered what it takes to make a daily talk show program like The Exchange? I'm Christina Phillips, one of the producers for the show. And so first, we all get around and we share ideas.
I just want to follow up on that.
We are looking for a pitch that's timely, it's compelling, and relevant.
I got something in my mailbox at home yesterday. Hiring census takers. So I'd love to look at how the census is going to roll out in New Hampshire.
We figure out what kind of guests we need, what sort of voices can talk about that issue. And then we do research and we check the facts. the day of. An engineer is making sure the mics are on and things are to time.
30 seconds standby.
And then it's all systems go.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange.
And we have a call screener who listens to your questions and concerns every single day. It's actually usually one of us. And connects you to the conversation.
Good morning. You've reached The Exchange call screener. Can I get your first name, where you're calling from?
Hi. I know that we have to legally respond to the census, and I know that the Supreme Court is...
The show wraps up, and we start all over again to prepare for tomorrow's show. So every step of this is really important, and it's true when we say that it all starts with you. When you give every month, you make everything you hear and everything that goes on behind the scenes possible. Join the Exchange team now by becoming an NHPR sustainer.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the development of rail trails in New Hampshire. Send us a picture of your favorite or an email with your questions before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that conversation. This hour, we're looking at the role that the state's nonprofits play in creating affordable housing. And we've been hearing from you. Send your emails to exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, Michael sent us a note. He says, are there any state or municipal legislative obstacles you're facing? Are there towns that are getting it right? So I want to hear from everybody on this, but Dean, you first. You alluded to this earlier in the hour, the idea that sometimes it's restrictions and regulations that prevent lower cost housing from being constructed.
Sure. So I think one of the things that contributes to the cost of housing development in New Hampshire, and one of the reasons why we have such a shortage, has been local regulatory policies that are either very restrictive or are perceived of as adding cost and risk to developers. And there have been communities, I think, over the last 10 years that have made a major effort to try to address that issue. And as a result, we're seeing some more development of different types, particularly in the southern part of the state, different development models that will lead to mixed use and smaller houses and more multifamily development, which was not sort of the traditional New Hampshire model, which ultimately should address some of the issues that Rosemary alluded to earlier about this imbalance we have between very small households, for the most part, and demand for smaller homes and a lot of really big houses that are in very rural environments. But we still need to do more about that. And we need to continue to work both at the state and the local level on how we can encourage communities to be more flexible, to identify ways that they can work with the development community, both nonprofit and for-profit, to build less expensive units, to build smaller housing, things that people refer to as compact development models that really not just reduce the cost of housing, but also speak to changing consumer tastes. The idea that people want a walkable community. They want to be able to ride their bike somewhere. They don't want to drive an hour or 2 hours to work or to services all the time. So these are things that really require fundamental changes in approach at the local level in New Hampshire, given the way we do things. And that takes time and can be very painful in
some
places.
Go ahead, Rosemary. Yeah.
Yeah. So feeding off of what Dean just said, one of the things that we need to get better at here, particularly on the homeownership side, is cluster development. A true cluster development is a walkable community, a cottage community, for example. And the rest of the land is available for recreation. We do not do a great job at that throughout the state. And I think having mixed income communities, after all, organically, cities and towns have a range of housing options that are affordable to people. The notion of putting all of the low-income or moderate-income people in one development, to me, is not an attractive proposition. And New Hampshire Housing has been terrific at really moving the needle on that and encouraging all of us to create mixed-income developments and mixed-use developments as well.
What examples would you give, Rosemary, of communities, as our emailer put it, that have done a good job building the type of smaller, more affordable housing that people these days say they want?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure I have the answer to that. But what I do have the answer to is a great example of a development that we recently completed, which was a historic rehab of a mill building right in Franklin at the confluence of all the rivers there. And that was a partnership with the city. Huge support. So where we add cost to the development process, whether you're a for-profit or nonprofit, is being stuck in that place where it takes years to develop a property. And if it takes 1 or 2 years, you are sitting with all of the carrying costs for that development. So to be able to partner and have the community with whom you're working understand your process and understand that at the end of the day, we are delivering something that perhaps eliminates blight or preserves a historic resource and provides housing at the same time, that is really the best of all possible
worlds.
It's
a win-win for you win-win for downtown Franklin.
Absolutely.
Mike, to our emailer's question, it's a great question. Local public policies that either help or get in the way.
Well, I'd like to just add on the comments that Dean and Rosemary has added. The term density is one that comes to mind. One of the largest challenges that we have, especially in the rural communities, is the zoning laws, the existing zoning laws that only allow so many, you know, homes to be built in so much of an area. So if some of that could be refined and changed so that it would allow for multifamily developments or cluster building, like Rosemary points out, that would be that would go a long ways towards trying to help.
So what's the opposition to that?
They have this idea that they want everything to stay the way it is, stay the same.
Are you saying we're stuck in our stuck in our traditions?
And there are also, I mean, there is this romantic idea that every house should be built on a 5-acre lot. And so that needs to be changed, even in the rural communities.
Rosemary?
A couple of years ago, we brought in an architect here to Concord. His name is Ross Chapin. He's from the West Coast, Washington State. And he's really the guru of small, tiny home communities. And I think as our state ages and people want to be closer together, to be able to have, you know, 5 or 10 tiny homes facing inward on a beautiful garden courtyard is something that we would all like to have in our senior years. So I think the aging of New Hampshire is going to force this issue a little bit and look at how we do development and how we look at development.
Back to our listeners and Alex calling from Rochester. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm wondering if it would be an option to expand what I think was formerly called the Section 8 program. It's based on a person's income, not on their ability to work or disability. It's just based on one's income. I myself am on Section 8. My rent for my one-bedroom apartment in Rochester is $800, but I only pay $163 per month. It's based on my income, and if I work more than I do, my rent goes up. It's like an equation. I didn't know if that might be possible, like one of the possible factors, or one factor that might possibly address the issue of affordable housing, if we were to expand that kind of program so that people's rent and or mortgages could be partially subsidized.
I'm so glad you called, Alex, because we have not talked about Section 8, Dean, and just remind our listeners what Section 8 is.
Sure. That's a term that really applies to a variety of federal programs that are rent subsidy programs, and there's a portable version of it that is known as the Housing Choice Voucher Program, and then there are project-based versions of it where the subsidy is concentrated in a particular building. And I don't know which of those Alex is part of. The concept of that program is exactly as he described it. It is a rent subsidy program. It's a rental assistance program that helps low-income people by paying a portion of their rent. They pay another portion. They either choose to live in privately owned homes, or perhaps they're in nonprofit developed properties, or they're in a project that was developed with that in mind. And it does provide a very affordable alternative for folks in that context. That program serves a lot of people across the state. It continues to do that. It has not expanded substantially over the years as needs have changed and expanded, not in New Hampshire and not nationally. And that's really been because it's a relatively expensive program at the federal level. And what Congress has done is sort of made a commitment to maintaining a flow of funding to support the people that have historically been funded, but only making very marginal increases in the amount of additional resource. So, for instance, we operate a program that is a tenant-based program statewide. The voucher program serves about 3,600 households across the state. That number has grown very slightly over the last 10 years by only a couple of hundred units. And the result of that is that there's not a lot of turnover and not a lot more people can be served as demand changes.
So do people with Section 8 vouchers like Alex tend to live in one sort of what people call a Section 8 development, Dean,
no,
or are they sprinkled out throughout
the
community?
All over. You would not know necessarily where they're living. They live where they choose to live in the community. Now, obviously, they need to have a landlord, a property owner who is prepared to work with the program and with them. But they live anywhere. They could be your neighbor. And there also are properties that were specifically built with the expectation that they would receive that funding. Many of those are senior properties. Many of them serve people with disabilities. And in those cases, they're a little more concentrated. But the voucher program, which is administered not only by us, but also by local housing authorities across the state and serves about in total 10,000 people, is invisible, if you will, as to where those folks live.
Well, thank you for the question, Alex, because we did need to talk about that. Real quick, Rosemary?
I think that voucher question that that was just raised also goes to the need. So there's about 7,500 people on the wait list throughout New Hampshire for a portable voucher. There's probably some overlap between some of the housing authorities and New Hampshire Housing, but it goes to the critical need for more affordable housing.
Let's go back to the phones, and Don is calling in from Conway. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. I live in Conway, New Hampshire. I live in a mobile home and a mobile home park, and there are three issues that the way I see it. Number one, all this nonsense of putting land into conservation use. We have about 2 million acres of land in New Hampshire already, which is designed for those people, you know, the doctors and lawyers who want to take a hike or whatever, to enjoy. How about if instead of paying these people millions of dollars to, quote-unquote, put their land into conservation use, we took the land and said, okay, we're going to build a well-managed mobile home park like I live in. There are 220 or 30 of us who live in here. My rent is $465 a month, and it's a beautiful, beautiful home. It's 22 years old. I'm 82. My wife is 78. You know, you have to do, you got to shovel your own snow and stuff like that. And so otherwise you'd have to hire somebody. So that's number one. Number two, anybody who thinks that you can live on a 40-hour-a-week job is crazy. During my working years, I worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day to support my wife and three kids.
Wow,
Don. My wife was a homemaker.
Yeah.
So, and then the other thing is, you know, they're always talking about student loan debt. I was a teacher and a coach and a gas station mechanic, et cetera, truck driver, and so on. And I had three children. One went to Harvard, one went to Dartmouth, one went to the University of New Hampshire, then they went to law school, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, they have zero debt because
wow.
That was our responsibility. That's, you know, if you can't afford to go to school, then you don't go.
Well, and Don, we've done whole hours on student debt, so I'll set that aside for now, although our guests have said, and you're right, Don, that is part of the affordability conversation. But I'm really interested in what he says about the conflict between preserving open space, which is a cherished value here in New Hampshire. We live here because it's beautiful. But sometimes that land then is not available for housing development. And I'm going to turn to you first, Mike. I know this is a tough one, but you're in a gorgeous area. You live in Littleton. You're in the North Country where people love to go and, you know, ski and snowmobile and hike and so forth. I just wonder what your thoughts are there about the decisions communities make as to whether to build small homes like the one Don lives in or to preserve open space.
It's a dialogue and a conversation that goes on all the time. I think you could also point to the over 55 communities that have been developed in the state and the number of those, and they're doing the same thing. They're, you know, specifically taking care of an older population that doesn't allow younger people to move into them. And as we develop more and more of these over 55 developments, it's going to even reduce the amount of land that's available for regular families. But I think this is a a discussion that will always be at the local level, and I don't know if there's a really easy answer for it.
And I want to ask you all about that as well, because again, that's there's a couple cultural values going on there. So I'm really glad Don called. But to your point, Mike, I'm glad you raised it about 55 plus housing. Do you guys at your organization AHEAD have age restricted housing? Affordable housing that you build?
We have about 450 units, and about 60% of them are 55 years and older, senior properties. They are, many of them are project-based subsidized rents that Dean was pointing to. And we also serve a lot of peoples with disabilities in those projects, too. So, we have our fair share of older residents.
Is that a balance you'd like to change to do a little bit less of this 55-plus housing so that you can open up the affordable housing to these young families that people say our workforce needs?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Oftentimes, how our properties are actually used is determined by the sources of the funding that comes
in.
I see. So some of these older, or most of these older properties, are monies that came from HUD. And they were specifically designed to take care of people over 55 and people with disabilities.
Housing and urban development. Okay, right. That's really interesting. So in a way, you have to follow the dictates of that housing, that funding you got from the federal government. I love your thoughts too, Dean and Rosemary, if we can fit it in this sort of idea of open space and affordable housing.
Things. First, Don's absolutely right. Manufactured housing is an affordable alternative, and we really should look at opportunities to expand where that can be used to create housing. And I also would argue that it gives you an opportunity to do that in a more compact environment, which makes sense. But I think the conflict between conservation land and housing is a little bit of an artificial one. And I'm not saying he's wrong, because I think that's the way it's played out. But it doesn't need to play out that way. One of the things Rosemary pointed to is that if you can build housing in a more compact way, you can use less land.
Which then you have allows more room for open space.
Allows you to achieve your goals of maintaining open space, but still get that housing done. The worst approach that you can take is to build lots of big houses on great big lots spread out over a lot of land, because that actually means that land is not available for other uses, and you're probably not going to be able to achieve any kind of affordability goals.
Rosemary, your last thoughts.
Thanks, Don, for calling in. I think the whole issue of manufactured housing is a really important one that we need to have more of a dialogue around. New Hampshire Community Loan Fund and Rock USA has been doing a ton around resident-owned communities and actually changing over folks who have been renting historically to ownership in mobile home parks. And congrats on the wonderful kids and the education. Obviously, your hard work paid off. It is something that we need to talk more about and look more at those opportunities statewide.
Well, all of you, I did want to ask all of you very quickly, but Dean, I'll just ask you, how much are the presidential candidates that are roaming all over New Hampshire talking about these issues that you and Rosemary and Mike have been talking about today?
Housing has not been on the national agenda a whole lot. I do believe that Senator Warren did come out with a plan early on that's pretty comprehensive, but I haven't really seen much from any of the other candidates.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for being
here.
Thank
you for having
me. Really appreciate
it.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.